right. So it's only been 2 months. It's fine. No big deal. I hoped to have had evolved with my sound quality and equipment by this point, but as is my life, I have a weird curse where nothing ever works, and everyone always says, we've never seen that before, when I call to tell people, nothing works. So anyway, at Movo, you kind of suck, but they are going to replace my equipment, but it's going to take a few more weeks, so until then, it still sounds like shit, so it's fine. We're going to talk today, though, about Michelle Harris. If you didn't already know this story, you may have heard a little bit from a TikTok video, I don't want to say series, but like an installment part that I did a few months ago about Michelle. I think the few of you that follow along with this podcast are TikTok transplants, so you may be familiar, but we're going to kind of just get into a little bit more detail here in this podcast episode. So kind of a little bit of a backstory about Michelle. She was a 35-year-old on September 11th, 2001. Now, that day is pretty significant. So there was a lot of things maybe overshadowing her story, and a lot of people feel that it took away a bit from her story. So we want to make sure that we get it out there. So on September 11th, 2001, as I said, 35-year-old Michelle Harris was preparing for her waitressing shift at her home in Spencer, New York. Now, this home was more of an estate. It actually sprawled across over 200 acres, and she shared it with her soon-to-be ex-husband, Calvin, better known as Cal Harris. In the late 1980s, a recent college graduate, Michelle Taylor, met Cal Harris while she was working as a receptionist for one of the Harris family's automobile dealerships. Cal actually came from a very prominent family in the community. They owned several dealerships. And a romance between them budded quickly, and in 1990, Michelle and Cal married on the Harris family Empire Lake property. In 1992, they built their lakeside home at 381 Hagedorn Hill Road, and between the years of 1994 and 1999, the couple had four children together, Taylor, Kayla, Jenna, and Tanner. Taylor, the oldest, was only 7 at the time of his mother's disappearance, and Tanner, the youngest, was 2. Spoiler alert, if you didn't know, this is a missing persons case. Family and friends believed the Harris family to be living the picture-perfect life for many years from all accounts. However, as we all know, things are rarely what they seem. In 1999, Michelle discovered Cal was having an affair with a woman named Constance that he had met at a Cortland County dealership owned by his brother. Michelle confronted Cal, and he promised to break things off, and they both wanted to work on saving their marriage. It wouldn't last long, though, because Cal was reported meeting Constance in Daytona Beach, Florida in March of 2000. So 8 months prior to Michelle's disappearance on December 8th, 2000, she told Cal she wanted a divorce, and Cal was less than pleased, to say the least. Michelle's sister-in-law was on the phone with her that evening and reported hearing Cal screaming while Michelle told him not to come near her. She tried to flee their home, and Cal used his truck to block Michelle's car in the garage. However, she was able to get to her brother's home, where she also later took all of Cal's guns. So she files for divorce on January 19th, 2001, and what Cal did next was a little bit strange. He contacted Michelle's family and friends and asked for their help in talking Michelle out of the divorce proceedings. He told them that he was concerned with Michelle's new friends and worried about possible drug usage. He admitted to her family and friends that he had been unfaithful, but he said that the marriage's failure was partly to blame on the fact that Michelle didn't keep the house clean. Sometimes this audio medium is difficult because I wish you could see my face right now. So during their marriage, Michelle was a stay-at-home mom to her four young children, and after deciding to file for divorce, she began waitressing at Lefty's, which was a restaurant and a bar in Waverly, New York. And that started around April 2001, just for some spending money because Cal had stopped providing her with any money once she decided to file for divorce. Michelle and Cal were still residing in the same household during their separation. Michelle just slept on the couch. But her friends say that she did have plans to purchase a new home with her boyfriend, 23-year-old Brian Early, whom she had met in November of 2000 at a bar called Wits End in Nichols, New York, when Brian was there on a hunting trip from Pennsylvania. By June of 2001, Brian had broken up with his girlfriend and moved to New York, renting an apartment to which Michelle had a key. Some of her earnings from Lefties were to be applied toward her half of the $10,000 down payment on a house on Main Street in Owego, close to her children's school. Michelle had plans to meet a friend from college in the city on September 14th and 15th to try and sell some of her jewelry as well. But because of the terrorist attacks that had occurred that morning, the plans would most certainly be halted. In addition to these plans, Michelle was scheduled to meet with her attorney on September 12th in preparation of her October 22nd divorce trial. Now, back on August 6th of 2001, Michelle had filed paperwork with the intent to seek appraisal of the Harris family's dealerships. And in this paperwork, it was requested to charge the appraisal fee, which was $30,000, to Cal. At this time, Cal's net worth was approximately $5.4 million, and he had previously been ordered to pay a variety of bills for Michelle, $10,000 worth of her legal fees and $400 per month. So back to the afternoon of September 11th, Barbara Thayer, which was Michelle and Cal's babysitter, arrived at the Harris home around 3 p.m. Michelle took off for Lefties in her gold-colored 2000 Ford Windstar van. Her shift ended around 9 p.m. and she hung around in the Lefties parking lot with two coworkers to discuss the terrorist attacks from that day, like everybody else was doing. And in fact, when I was researching this, it struck me as like a little bit odd that people were still going out to bars and grills that close to the city. I don't know. I'm not from the area, so I don't understand, but I just thought it was a little strange. So from there, she drove to Smithboro, which was about 10 miles east of Waverly, to Brian's apartment. And Brian says that they sat and talked for about an hour, and when he walked her to her van around 11 p.m., she was, you know, putting her life into perspective after the day's events. She was hopeful and kind of excited about this new chapter in her life, and Brian says that he leaned in to give her a kiss goodbye, and that was the last time that he saw her. By 7 a.m. on September 12th, she had not returned home to the home she shared with Cal. So Cal calls Barbara, the babysitter, and asks if she can come get the kids ready for school that day. When Barbara turned onto the driveway at the Harris property, now this is a quarter mile long driveway. So from the Harris home, it's not visible. The end of the driveway isn't easily seen from the home. So she turns onto the driveway and she immediately sees that Michelle's van is sitting at the end of the driveway, keys still in the ignition. She gives the van a quick look through, makes her way up to the house, and she tells Cal, who's already dressed in his suit and his tie ready for work, about the van at the end of the driveway. He tells her that they better go get it. And on the way down the driveway, Barbara starts asking if they should look for Michelle, that maybe she could be hurt. Cal allegedly tells Barbara that they didn't need to search for Michelle because she had went to the city to meet a friend. When Barbara questions how she got there because they're standing in front of the van, Cal says, oh, she probably hitched a ride. Okay, so while looking around inside the van, which was cluttered with mail, clothing, kids' toys, food wrappers, Cal tells Barbara that the van is clearly a mess and he's got to go get it cleaned. So Barbara gets in the van, drives it up to the house, and parks it in the garage. After Cal leaves for work, Barbara tries Michelle's cell phone and then a friend of Michelle's to ask if she had seen her. The friend's like, no, and she calls Michelle's attorney, who called Lefties and Michelle's cell phone. She obviously wasn't at Lefties and not answering her phone, so shortly after, Michelle's attorney contacts the police and officially reports her missing. Later in the morning of September 12th, New York State police investigators made a visit to Cal at work. He did tell police that it was unusual for Michelle not to be home in the mornings, and he said that she never came home after her shift. He was fully cooperative. He signed off on a search of his property and offered up the van for investigation. After he offered the van, though, he did tell investigators that he wanted it back because it needed an oil change. And he made a comment about how Michelle never changed the oil. What? He also told investigators that Michelle was hanging out with a bad crowd in Waverly, and they should focus their investigation there. On September 14th, investigator Steve Anderson arrived for the first time to the Harris home. He explains that he entered through the open garage door where he noticed blood stains on the floor and on the doorway moldings leading out to the garage. Dozens of tiny blood stains on a kitchen carpet, and he reports seeing blood on the garage floor and small amounts under paint chips and in scratches. Something else that he noticed was evidence of cleanup, as the stains were partly diluted. All of the blood found inside the home and the garage came back as matching Michelle's blood. When first questioned, Cal claimed he had no idea how the blood could have wound up on these surfaces, but later during questioning, he remembered that once his son had got a cut on his finger and left droplets of blood throughout the garage. Blood experts did determine that the blood spots were at an angle, indicating it would have had to come from someone at or below 29 inches. And just because it came back as matching Michelle's blood, that also could mean that it was a relative of Michelle. So the son, small, it would make sense. For days, investigators searched for any signs of Michelle or foul play. Divers searched the 40-acre pond and used sonar. Investigators used dogs and helicopters, but all of this was to no avail. They came up with absolutely nothing. No blood in Michelle or Cal's vehicles. The fingerprints found on and in Michelle's van were of Brian's and Cal's, except a set of fingerprints belonging to a third person have never been identified to this day. Strange. Even though Barbara drove Michelle's van that day, her fingerprints were not found. No body, no weapon, you know, they had nothing. So after Michelle's disappearance, reports of turmoil from inside the home began to emerge. Mary Jo Harris, Cal's sister-in-law, recalled an incident in 1996 that explained a little bit more reasoning behind Michelle's decision to remove Cal's guns from the home after their December 2000 fight. Mary Jo states that Michelle called her from a closet inside the Harris home, and she was upset and whispering about a fight that she had been in with Cal. Michelle told Mary Jo that Cal was opening and closing the chamber of a shotgun. Mary Jo also claims that she confronted Cal the weekend after Michelle went missing about that incident and other threats that he made to Michelle. And at first, Cal said that Michelle was just a habitual liar, but later he did admit that he may have threatened her, but didn't mean any of it. In an interview in 2018, Cal responds to a question about the domestic violence reports by saying if those rumors were true, then Michelle would have included them in her divorce papers. The interviewer actually had obtained a copy of the paperwork filed by Michelle, and when reading all of the allegations of physical abuse in Michelle's own words, including a murder threat by Cal, he says that she was just simply trying to obtain temporary custody of the home and would say whatever she needed to. Cal also admits during this interview that he took a polygraph test and the results came back inconclusive, whereas New York State police say he failed the test. Cal says that he would have had no motive to kill Michelle because the divorce settlement was, he claims Michelle agreed to, but others say she rejected, so it's a little up in the air of the credibility of this statement. But he says that this settlement of $800,000, which would have been spread out over 10 years, was his offer to Michelle, and he knew that it would be manageable. He says that he knew she had one boyfriend, and even though he wasn't aware of the others, which we will circle back around to in just a bit, jealousy as a motive would have been out because he already knew, you know, they were both active participants in extramarital affairs. So he does say, though, that he always held out hope that they would work things out. So if Michelle was, you know, moving on and preparing to buy a new home with her boyfriend, then it does beg the question that maybe jealousy would have been a motive if he was guilty of killing his wife. 4 years later, on September 30th, 2005, Cal was indicted by a Tioga County grand jury on one count of second-degree murder in the disappearance of Michelle. During Cal's first trial, District Attorney Gerald Keene argues that Cal struck Michelle with a blunt object, and once she fell on the floor in front of the garage, Cal struck her again, which is what causes the alleged blood spatter. Forensic scientist Dr. Henry Lee, who consulted on the O.J. Simpson and JonBenet Ramsey cases, testified that the droplets of blood found within the Harris home were vivid red and, in his opinion, 2 to 3 days old. After 2 weeks of trial, a jury found Cal guilty of the murder charge. But the very next day, 6 years after Michelle's disappearance, Kevin Tubbs, a local farmer, came forward after apparently seeing a newspaper article of Cal's guilty verdict, and he claims that he saw a blonde woman that looked like Michelle arguing with a younger man near a dark-colored pickup, I believe it was a Chevrolet pickup, around 5:30 to 6 a.m. at the end of the Harris driveway. Now, this would have been the time that prosecutors alleged Michelle was killed, so if Kevin's statement is to be believed, that would rule Cal out. Because of this, Judge Martin Smith orders Cal's release. Judge Smith had taken the place of Vincent, and I could not find how you pronounce this last name, so I'm going to butcher it. It's Seguglia? I have no idea. But he was the first judge, and he actually stepped down from the case after accusations from the DA about favoritism shown for Cal and his defense attorney. He denied the allegations, but he did end up stepping down. So Cal's just out, you know. This has been overturned because of this man's testimony 6 years later. Now, I try to stay as objective as I can, but sometimes it's really hard not to put in my own personal opinion about things. And just a thought that I had while I was researching was, this is a man with a very prominent family. You know, money is not really an issue in a lot of situations with this family. So Cal gets a guilty verdict, and then the very next day, all of a sudden, 6 years later, this farmer is like, oh, picked up the newspaper, and I just remembered something I should have said 6 years ago. It's just, I don't know. That was me. But either way, Judge Smith thought it was good enough. So in February of 2007, Cal was indicted once more on a second-degree murder charge. By June 2007, a jury found him guilty after 10 hours of deliberation. In November 2007, his murder conviction is once more thrown out, citing the testimony of Kevin Tubbs. Cal is out free on a $500,000 bond, and a new trial is ordered. In August 2009, Cal was found guilty of second-degree murder again by a jury. A new judge, James Hayden, sentences Cal to 25 years to life. A 2011 appeal was denied, but a 2012 appeal resulted in another overturned conviction, and in October of 2012, Cal is once again free on a $500,000 bond while awaiting a third trial. In 2015, a jury was unable to come to a unanimous decision, and a mistrial is declared. A fourth trial is ordered, but this time, Cal opts not to appear before a jury. In 2016, Judge Richard Mott had heard arguments from the defense team about how two steelworkers from Texas, Stacy Stewart and Christopher Tomlinson, were living in Tioga County in September 2001 and had murdered Michelle. On May 24th, 2016, Judge Mott returned with a not guilty verdict, and Cal Harris has been a free man since. Who are Stacy Stewart and Christopher Tomlinson, you ask? Stacy and Michelle were allegedly sleeping together beginning around April of 2001, when Stacy would frequent Lefty's. An ex-girlfriend of Stacy's testified that in 2015, she questioned Stacy about his involvement with Michelle. Initially, Stacy denied knowing having any knowledge of Michelle's disappearance, but later admits he was the last person to be seen with Michelle alive, according to his ex-girlfriend. In January 2016, an excavation of a burn pit at a property owned previously by Stacy, which was located about 8 miles from the Harris home, turned up women's items, a partial shoulder strap from a brawl, a women's bathing suit top, or it could have been a halter top, as well as burnt light and blue colored fabric, which would have matched Michelle's work uniform for the last day she was seen alive. She was wearing a blue polo and I believe khaki shorts. They also found what appeared to be a latch and a clasp from a woman's handbag, which was one of the only items that was missing from Michelle's van. So when investigators searched the van, they found Michelle's cell phone with one missed call. They found a Rolex box, but it was empty. And they found evidence of the bag of jewelry that she was carrying around because, you know, she was going to try and sell some of her jewelry. So her purse was missing, and they find parts of what appears to be a purse in this burn pit. Cal's defense team said that these items could be dated to the time period when Stacy owned the property. Witnesses also gave statements that Thomason told them that he showed up to Stacy's house and Stacy was covered in blood, saying that he had skinned a deer. None of the items that were found were ever conclusively linked to Michelle. Regarding Stacy, though, the Taylor family was not convinced. Michelle's niece, Kelsey Taylor, claims that Michelle kept a journal, but her family could not discuss what was written or what Michelle had told her parents. Kelsey, who now studies law, also says, quote, "We feel that Stacy Stewart has been planted by the defense, and he doesn't have anything to do with my aunt's disappearance and murder." She claimed that Stacy had passed a polygraph test and had timesheets from work to prove that he wasn't responsible. An important note of the 2016 trial is when DA Kirk Martin said that Taylor, Michelle and Cal's oldest child, mentioned his father being out of bed around 3 a.m. during a family dinner conversation the evening following Michelle's disappearance. When questioned, Taylor testified that he did not remember this conversation, but honestly, would he be expected to? He was 7 years old at the time of his mother's disappearance. All four of the Harris children have steadfastly supported their father's claims of innocence. A few testimonies that also stuck out during Cal's trials were when Barbara testified that 1 week after Michelle disappeared, Cal told her that he wanted Michelle's belongings out of their house and she could sell the items at a garage sale and he would split any profits with her. Barbara goes on to say that around 2 weeks after that conversation, on Michelle's birthday, actually, Cal talked his girlfriend Constance into spending the night at the Harris home. Constance was hesitant, but in an attempt to reassure her, Cal told her that Michelle would not be coming home that night. In July 2001, Michelle was at a hair appointment and had received a call from Cal. According to her stylist, Jerome Wilchinski, during testimony, Cal was screaming and told Michelle if she didn't drop the divorce proceedings, he would kill her and could make her disappear. The defense team, though, asked why Jerome did not include this information during his initial conversation with police in 2001. Now, Francine Harris, another sister-in-law of Cal, testified that Cal became so upset when Mary Jo confronted Cal about his threatening statements that he became pale and he went to the bathroom, emerging a few minutes later looking as if he had been physically ill. Francine also testified that during this weekend, she answered a call from Dwight Harris, Cal's father, and he stated that Michelle's body had been found in a shallow grave at his cottage. Cal told Francine that Michelle had not been found and his father was, quote, a buffoon. In June 2016, shortly after his not guilty verdict, Cal was charged with a stalking misdemeanor as he was allegedly harassing and verbally threatening an off-duty officer outside of his home. Cal denies the charge, saying that he was minding his own business when the officer confronted him and asked where he had buried Michelle, and that the police are trying to get even with him. In July 2016, a protection order was issued preventing Cal from having any contact with the officer or his family, and he was also ordered to surrender all of his guns. A book published in August of 2020, written by defense investigator David Beers, is said to outline the reasons behind Cal's innocence and provide an in-depth account of the, quote, scandalous case facts not to be found anywhere else. Once I read this book, because I am going to read it, maybe there might be a little update to this episode, because it'll be interesting to see what facts we cannot find elsewhere. In 2017, the 252-acre Harris home was sold to a man who was actually involved in a 2019 political donation controversy around the construction of a community center. That really isn't relevant to the case. It's just while I was looking up deed records, I saw that and I just wanted to mention it. Maybe the property is, you know, got some bad juju or something. In August of 2020, he sold the home to Empire Lake Ranch LLC. I haven't been able to determine if that is linked to Cal and his family. I just have a suspicion that it is, but I can't find that information. So Michelle Harris remains missing. She nor her body have ever been found to this day in 2021. Sue Mulvey, a New York Police Department investigator, she took the call initially about Michelle being missing on September 12th and said that the area of the Harris home was heavily homesteaded in the 1800s. So there's a lot of wells and old foundations throughout the property. Cal, though, in that 2018 interview, says that Sue was never looking for Michelle. He accuses Sue of having a conflict of interest because her father previously worked for him and was fired by Cal. So Cal thinks that he was being targeted and Sue was only focused on making him the prime suspect, excuse me, rather than finding Michelle. But Sue does have one thing right. There are 252 acres, 40 of it being underwater, and ample spots for a body to possibly still be hiding to this day. I mean, of course, we want Michelle to still be out there alive, doing well. Maybe she left for reasons that we won't understand, but if there is a chance, the New York State Police contact information will be included in the show notes, as well as a description of Michelle at the time of her disappearance, just in case anyone might have the slightest piece of information. Because at the end of the day, circulating these missing person stories is ultimately the goal to bring closure to families who still need to know what happened to their baby, their sister, their aunt, their mother, their ex-wife even, maybe. So if anybody has just even the slightest piece of information that you have known for even years and you thought it would never be helpful, you never know what could be helpful. So with that, I thank you for always your patience and waiting for this to maybe get better, or waiting for 2 months for a new episode to come out. We'll see what happens from here. But in the meantime, you can always send me case suggestions or any type of feedback to my email, which is apinepodcast@gmail.com. Of course, on TikTok at Dusty Vibes, Dusty with an I. Instagram, where I do put pictures and things to coordinate with the cases that are covered, which is Apine for True Crime. And of course, the Patreon that I'm slowly trying to build up is patreon.com/apinepod, which should have some bonus episodes and content here very shortly. Hopefully by the time you check it, if anyone does.